Our next guest is Cameron Eshak, who served as a lead consultant for the U.S. Federal Highway Administration in development of national, local technical assistance and tribal technical assistance programs operating in all 50 states at the national, state, and local levels. I'm very happy to follow up with Cameron after speaking with Ron, because I believe Cameron is uniquely qualified to give us all a good working sense of how these programs were built and what they were intended to do and what we can learn from what worked and what didn't work. Thanks for joining today, Cameron.
Great to talk to you, Tyler.
A lot of people in the transportation world have heard the term LTAP. They've heard the term TTAP. TTAP, of course, stands for Tribal Technical Assistance Programs. LTAP stands for Local Technical Assistance Programs. What's the difference for our general audience who doesn't know what this alphabet soup of acronyms means? What's the difference between an LTAP and a TTAP?
It's an outstanding question, Tyler. First and foremost, we should probably point out that, and I think you've already heard from Ron, that the program, the TTAP side, was started in 1991. The LTAP program is a little older in the tooth, but for the most part, up until 2016, 17, they were run as one program. So in essence, a TTAP center was an LTAP center, and an LTAP center was simply a TTAP center in a non-tribal place. Both roughly do the exact same thing. Their role is to provide training, technical assistance, and technology transfer services, resources, training, and education to the populations in their catchment area. So for the 50 LTAP centers, that is the state in which they reside. Plus there is, as you already know, one in Puerto Rico. For the TTAP centers, of which there were seven, those were regionally distributed. They were supposed to do that for the tribal populations within their regional area. So they basically, those seven covered the entire nation. There was one in the Northwest, one in the Mountain West, one in Alaska, one in the Northern Plains, one in the Southern Plains, and one in the West. So those seven were essentially doing the job that the other 51 LTAP centers were doing nationally in their individual states. So they were doing the same things. However, the differences between the two are more illuminating than the similarities. Inside those core functions, the types of things that a TTAP would do would be very different. First and foremost, TTAP centers serve tribes. Tribes in this country have a very different socioeconomic, cultural, and historical background that state residents and state citizens and state organizations and governments that are within that state, like townships and counties and towns and cities, don't have. So there is that history of and resulting change in governance models and in self-determination that make the TTAP outlook a little bit different. The TTAP road systems that the tribal center are supporting are also a little bit different. We're talking about the National Tribal Transportation Inventory. It's about 157,000 miles, but those road miles are distributed a little bit differently than they would be in a state. 31,000 of those are BIA roads. About 26,000 of them are physically on a tribal system and on a tribal land. And the other roughly 101,000 are state and local roads that happen to run adjacent or within tribal land. So it's a much more problematic challenge for a TTAP center to provide the correct training, technical assistance, and technology transfer because of that mix. The other thing that is clear is that within the joint program, there were four focus areas. Three of them were really on the ground focus areas: safety, infrastructure, and workforce development. The hallmark of the large program would be safety, and both centers, LTAP and TTAP, heavily engage in safety training and technical assistance. But on a TTAP, worker safety was a larger chunk of what their course material and technical assistance material would be, as opposed to roadway safety, which might be, in most cases, an LTAP center's primary function. The other thing that's very important is the technical assistance aspect of what both centers perform for their constituents is very important. But a larger chunk of what a TTAP would do would be that very physical technical assistance. That is a subject matter expert going out to a road, going to a community, going to a local public works agency, and physically being on the ground to discuss a particular need on the roadway system, to show a new technology, or to demonstrate a capability across an entire range of things. We could be talking about anything from signaling to local road safety plans to road safety audits to simple signage and roadway behaviors. So that technical assistance aspect, given the disparities we talked about earlier in the populations, is really a mission critical aspect of what TTAPs were performing up to 2016, 2017. So that's a rough sense of the similarities, but the important differences between those two centers.
I appreciate that. Coming up to present day, it is a fact that local technical assistance programs in all 50 states have continued providing that, as you say, mission critical support for local agencies to address all of their local transportation needs. As of 2017, really, the regional model for TTAPs stopped. There was then a two-year pilot in 2018 and 2019 that took more of a national clearinghouse approach, which has subsequently stopped. Over the last 2+ years, tribal governments have not had any technical assistance in this regard. Is that accurate?
Yes, I think for the most part, the TTAP portion of whatever services they were getting has stopped or has been catch-as-catch-can. One of the things that the Federal Highway Administration intelligently tried to promote up through 2017 was as much cross-pollinization as possible between the two programs. They were multiple LTAPs, for example, fit into one TTAP region. So where a TTAP could connect to an LTAP resource, they were encouraged to do so to maximize the bandwidth they were able to provide tribal constituents in that area. So you lose that connection. You also lose the direct connection of the actual outputs from a TTAP center. That's up in the last known good data set before the end of the old system and the advent of the pilot. You're talking about training about 9,000 people a year in roughly 40,000 contact hours of training. That's about 400 training sessions a year. All of that came to a halt. So those are important parts of a tribal government's need for that important training, technical assistance, technology transfer, resources, materials, and training capabilities that simply went away. It's important to point out, Tyler, that this was not a top-heavy program by any means. We're talking at that last year, there were roughly 15 full-time equivalents nationwide running the 7 regional LTAP centers. So 15 people were providing the training, technical assistance, and technology transfer services to the 574 registered tribes within those areas, with disparate geographic, historical, cultural, and infrastructure state needs. So we're not talking about a very large program where folkways could be relied upon once it left to pick up the slack. We're really talking about the skeletal system that held everything together. Now, I would not be surprised that other folks stepped into the breach, either from other federal highway offices, federal lands highways, and BIA, but I don't think that the in toto sum of services provided by TTAPs could have been replicated without the dedicated TTAP program being in effect. Now, as for the pilot, the challenges of the pilot are obvious when you consider the specific needs of tribal lands. Having a centralized single source model made it very difficult to provide that diverse ethnographic, geographic, and cultural need set across the country, especially it was housed out of UVA, not necessarily a place that had a deep wellspring of tribal knowledge and experience. Now, that isn't to say that the university didn't do the best job it could given the conditions it was given. But what I think we are all saying is that it's very difficult to replicate a specific tribal voice without having tribal leaders, tribally trusted voices that have that cultural fluency providing that training. So You miss more than just the seven regional centers. You miss that focus, that alignment, and that accountability that makes the tribally relevant parts of those services stick and appear important and relevant to the people that are using those services. And that's a critical path factor in their success.
One thing that Ron Hall mentioned was his hope that there would come a day when tribal transportation leaders across the country would have the opportunity to convene and work within the equivalent of an AASHTO framework, a tribal AASHTO, so to speak. What are your thoughts on that kind of framework? I recognize all of the unique considerations that make tribal transportation very different from local transportation, non-tribal, the cultural, the anthropological aspects, the customs. Having said that, do you see merit in having a framework like that to serve as a clearinghouse, an advocacy vehicle for all things tribal transportation related?
I do. I've heard Ron make that argument before. It's a solid one. I think that what Ron is really speaking to there is an in-depth infrastructure that supports the tribal voice for transportation needs, be they workforce development needs, infrastructure needs, safety needs. And I think that that is missing. I think even AASHTO folks would concur that AASHTO, as good as it is at doing those things in various silos across the transportation and infrastructure spectrum, only has so much time to devote to, say, the tribal element to that. So what the tribal continuum has often lacked is that mission-specific voice, that culturally appropriate voice, and quite frankly, a tribal voice. There is a problem oft noted when you're out in a tribal area speaking to tribal leaders or trying to share technical assistance or information that comes from outside the tribal realm, that it has come from outside the tribal realm and is therefore being kind of pigeonholed into a tribal deployment. And I think what they're looking for is, as Ron is indicating, something that is uniquely tribal and that can support these very specific needs that we keep talking about. And the differences that you can't treat tribal roads and tribal transportation systems and tribal governments as simply another form of county government or local government, that they are entirely different for the historical reasons we've discussed, for the self-governance reasons that we've discussed. So I see the merit in it. Now, that's also, in all honesty, a gold-plated vision that would take a long time to implement. In the meantime, I think that whatever comes of the new and improved TTAP Mark II ought to incorporate some of that elemental thinking, that we're really trying for a bottom-up, grassroots, representative relationship with the tribes themselves, with tribal leaders themselves, and within these regions where you'll have multiple tribes in the same region, in the absence of having mission-specific TTAP centers for specific tribes or essentially more centers. I don't anticipate 51 TTAP centers. I do anticipate more than one, and I would be shocked if it didn't return to that regional model in one way, shape, or form. So whether there are 7, 9, or whatever the number, that AASHTO model can serve as a reboot template to start that ground-up approach. And if I could just say one more thing on that, Tyler, you know, that ground-up approach will be needed. This has been a very fraught time for the tribes. They had a system that was delivering services to them. We can discuss whether there could be changes, modifications, or improvements in that system. There can be changes, modifications, and improvements in any system. But they've lost that. So there's a trust factor that will have to be addressed. And I know FHWA will be doing that. This AASHTO model is one way of saying we're looking at this through a different lens. We're trying to bring equity to this situation. And that equity can come from that very grassroots AASHTO style approach that Ron was indicating. So I do see a future for it. I just think it'll take a long time, A, to rebuild that trust, and then B, to build out that infrastructure.
I appreciate that. And of course, equity has become this huge buzzword across the country in virtually every socioeconomic context that one could imagine. And I also agree that you're not going to build a tribal Ashto equivalent overnight. It does seem that one critical first step toward progress to this gold-plated vision of a tribal Ashto one day, and certainly equity for tribal communities across the nation, is developing a verifiable, accurate repository of tribal roads, bridges, transportation safety data. Right now, as somebody who is by no means an expert, but a thoughtful reader and experienced journalist, I can't make heads or tails of the tribal transportation picture. There seem to be too many fragmented data sets. Do you think that would be a good first step? And what do you think it would take to get a better baseline data set on essential tribal transportation benchmarks, indicators, so on and so forth?
It's an excellent question, Tyler. And I think there's two ways of approaching that challenge. One, I think, has been underway. It simply requires a little bit more headway. I think tribal governments, tribal leaders, BIA, FLH, and Federal Highways all have recognized the need for better GIS data, better mapping on tribal roads. And there have been initiatives to do so. The challenges there are no different in that respect from those of the urban to rural transition on national roads. We have much better data and mapping capability on the connectors and above level road than we do below that. I just think there needs to be a continued push to get that network mapped, get the infrastructure mapped, get the culverts, the bridges, and also crash data. There's two elements there. We can do the GIS mapping side, but the other challenge we've seen across the country is getting law enforcement on board with a unified format within an area to collect that crash data. That crash data is going to tell us where the hotspots are. It's going to allow us to plot fatalities, crashes, whether they're serious or minor, especially on these kinds of roads. These are not, for the most part, up to the same standard as you and I would assume. And that's by the BIA's own judgment. Roughly 83% of the roads on its systems do not reach the minimum standards that it has laid out for its infrastructure. So that's where that capturing the hot spotting of the challenges on the roadways is as important as the mapping of the roadways themselves and the infrastructure around it. And that includes signage, for example. I think another angle on that is almost as important is changing and or at least addressing the funding model itself. By the same token, as we've had challenges trying to fund the road system below connectors, simply because the VMT level isn't the same, right? So if you're talking about a connector and above, the mere fact that it has more traffic means it's going to have more roadway departures, more serious crashes, more minor crashes, more bike ped incidents. And we tend to overlook that lonely rural road where maybe only two people died. And I find that to be one of the most tragic statements that folks make in our industry. Only two people. Well, as we all know, zero is the appropriate measure of deaths on our highways. So using the tools that you're talking about, using that mapping and getting some of that crash data, but then addressing the need to fund these very rural roads, these roads that at first glance, and even with that data view, won't look as important or as valuable. And I'm using scare/air quotes when I say that, compared to high traffic, high volume urban roads, but are just as important to the folks that live in these areas that are, by the way, far flung. You've visited tribal areas, as have I. The state of infrastructure in some of these areas, I visited Alaska tribes on the Northern Plains. Once you get out of the main area, you can have a population that's as widely distributed as a national county. I've mentioned that I live in Fairfax County, which is a very large county in Virginia. It's also the wealthiest or second wealthiest county in the United States. We don't want for anything here in terms of funding. All the roads are beautiful. I don't think there's a gravel road in this county. That comes with a multi-billion dollar public works budget. We're underfunding these roads that are depaving at an alarming rate and are gravel roads that haven't had dust suppression, that don't have the safety edge on the side or aren't graded correctly to prevent roadway departures. We have folks in tribal areas walking along those roads as well. So we have a lot of bike ped incidents with traffic. These are things that wouldn't raise a data analysis level amongst anyone, but are still vitally important to those populations. So if we can switch that mentality from focusing on high VMT areas and considering that local and rural areas, because they don't have the same data levels of tragedy, are therefore ignorable, I think is as important as getting the data itself to tell us that. Because our experience in some of the states, and Minnesota, I think, was a bellwether here, years ago decided that 50% of that safety money was going to go local and rural roads, regardless of, you know, the data level, and immediately saw a dramatic decrease in the sorts of adverse events that we just spoke about. If we could have a view like that on tribal roads and could get Congress and others to realize that the challenge on tribal roads is serious and is as important as some of these other things, I think we would be just as efficient and effective as if we had all the data in the world and all the resources in the world to address it.
Cameron, moving ahead, we can always look back and find fault, and we can also take a more adaptive approach and think what worked and what didn't work and what should we do in the future. So looking at it from 100 miles up, I can see that the pilot carried out in 2018 and 2019 seems to have made resolutely clear that a national model doesn't work when you compare it to the benefits of a regional model, considering that the realities of tribal technical assistance in Alaska are much different than in California, New Mexico, Arizona, the realities in the Midwest, in the Northeast, all very different, seasonal, environmental, cultural, all kinds of things. There is consensus across the board that this TTAP program is directed by federal statute. It will be reconstituted. What's going to be determined is how effective the program is in really identifying priorities for equity and mobility in Indian country. How do we promote and improve access, continue a legacy of safety and economic opportunities? You know, LTAPs certainly don't stand in the way of the free enterprise system, nor should TTAPs. If tribal governments want to be enterprising and entrepreneurial, that ought to be part of the equation too. So if you were to look back and think these are the most important things to preserve from the past TTAP efforts, and then take a look at the future and offer a few suggestions for where things ought to go, how would you feel that one?
Well, it probably comes as no surprise as someone who spent the better part of a couple of decades in LTAP, TTAP world that I thought that the old system was working, although I think it needed some tweaks and improvements. And I mean that for the entire program, not just the TTAP side. And I think that the best part of FHWA's stewardship of the program has been a sense that there was a need for continuous improvement. And I think they were working towards that end up until we reached that stage of 2016, 2017. So first and foremost, I would hope for a return to the regional model, because I think the national model did not serve the purpose of meeting the needs as you just laid them out. And I've hit on the rebuild trust element, but I think that that is almost paramount to everything. I think that the trust of tribal leaders, tribal governments, and the folks that rely on those services and have had them gone missing has been broken to an extent. I know FHWA has the right people in place to address that, and I know that will happen, but that will take time. From there, however, I think there is as in any rebuilding opportunity, there's a great opportunity, quite frankly. I hate to repeat myself, but there's an opportunity here to do things a little bit differently. And I think if we are able to get a better sense of the tribally specific needs and assessment of where the tribal transportation system is now. What are the emerging issues? What are their training, technical assistance, and technology needs? What resources do they have and where are they going? How has the last 5 years changed that view? Because there will have to be a bit of a relearning curve there. I think that would be the first thing that I'd be looking at, other than the model being correct and the trust being rebuilt. I also think that, quite frankly, if the challenge has been trying to fit the LTAP model into a TTAP space, then let's flip the switch on that and change the polarity to what are those local public agency skills and needs for that workforce on tribal lands. We talk a lot in LTAP world about how a guy in a public works department might be the, you know, the local road supervisor. He might also be the county judge. He might also be the public works guy. That is even more so in a tribal government. I attended a tribal governmental meeting for an Alaska tribe. The entire governance model was three people doing every job. There was about four or five folks there representing the state and FHWA, me being one, and some others. But the folks that were doing the governing for this particular tribe, there was three of them, and they had to cover every possible functionality from healthcare to infrastructure to the social work to the cultural work that the tribe was doing. So we need to know what their needs are, and they're not going to be the same needs as a county or a township or a city. They're going to be very different for all of the reasons we kicked off the podcast talking about. So having a tribal worldview and a tribal focus on the gaps and overlaps in their workforce needs, let's find out those clusters of knowledge, skills, and capabilities that they need to do their job to make transportation on tribal land safe and efficient and effective and bring economic prosperity and equity to those places. And also a needs assessment, I think, of where tribal lands are headed. We have seen some economic development, and we have heard talk of bigger opportunities for economic development on tribal lands. It's been a particular conversation that seems to be increasing in volume over the last 20 years. And of course, through the lens of everything we've seen on the diversity, equity, and inclusion front in the last few years, I'm assuming that this is a moment where we may see more of that. So is that infrastructure ready to meet that challenge? And in many cases, it may be, and in some cases, it probably isn't. So there's another opportunity to really get an assessment of what the future needs will be for tribal transportation systems and start meeting those needs now at the ground level to help gauge, prepare for, and then and empower that change on those tribal lands. And I think the opportunity, while I think it was unfortunate that the pilot was not successful, I think it is now an opportunity to think about the best things about the old program and sort of graft them on to some of these new approaches. We could end up with a more efficient and effective TTAP element than has ever been seen. And then I think one that is also scaled for sustainability and growth in the long term. Those things can only benefit the tribes that they serve.
Like all big mega trends, there gets a point in our culture where lip service is paid to a big idea that makes everybody feel warm and fuzzy, but there's very little in the way of substance on how to carry out these lofty ideas of equity and mobility to ensure that Americans, wherever they live, can get where they need to go and get the things they need for their families and their communities. And I think drilling down and identifying these very important elements that you're talking about meet not only the spirit of the moment, but also the letter of it. How do we really write it down and carry it out? The only thing that I can add to your great rundown, Cameron, is that I think once this is locked in place, it would be good to, of course, let the research take us there. Ask the constituents, ask the community members that really work and live this. Learn from them, from the grassroots up, and then build in, like great organizations in the public and private sector always do, mechanisms to initiate discussions for continuous improvement. How can we learn on an annual basis, retool, fix it, intermittently, not waiting for some huge breakdown. And I think that really comes back to a really inclusive, engaged, principal conversation. And that's the conversation I've been having today with Ron Hall and with yourself. And I now look forward to continuing that with Kelly Myers, talking directly about transportation and the service of mobility and equity. And what does that mean? I'd like to thank you for your time today and for all of your thoughtful comments, Cameron, and look forward to continued discussions.
Anytime, Tyler. Great talking to you.